Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now, back to the United States, and we were reporting on this yesterday just after the Baltimore Bridge collapsed. And Maryland State Police now say that the six people who were missing after the bridge collapsed are presumed dead at this stage. This is U.S. Coast Guard Rear Admiral Shannon Gilreath on their decision to stop the search.
Based on the length of time that we've gone in the search, the extensive search efforts that we've put into it, the water temperature, that at this point we do not believe that we're going to find any of these individuals still alive. And so we are going to suspend the active search and rescue efforts. We've got very difficult water temperatures. You have structures from the bridge that are in the water that can move with the tides and currents, making that dangerous for divers and people in the water to actually try to do recovery. And we do not want to injure any of these first responders in this recovery effort. We absolutely want to be as safe as possible for everyone involved in this.
And if you were listening yesterday, you would have heard Sean Boyce, the Irish master mariner, explaining to us that because of all of that movement in the water, it is treacherous. Chris Reynolds is the former director of the Irish Coast Guard and former head of the EU crisis mission to Somalia. And Chris is on the line now. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Claire.
I'm sure that's not an easy decision for any group of emergency service personnel to make. Can you tell us what goes into making that call and that ultimate decision to suspend the search?
Well, I suppose there's a couple of factors. First thing is that the workers would have been in normal clothes. They wouldn't have had special clothes on that would have kept them warm. There would have been a traumatic fall from the bridge, so there would have been trauma involved. The water temperature is about 8 degrees, and so after about 60 minutes, basically your limbs don't work and you begin to go unconscious. So really after 90 minutes of that temperature, the chances of survival are very, very low. So the call was obviously the correct call.
Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't be surprised that that call was made when it was announced?
No, I wouldn't be surprised. Obviously, they would have had to talk to the families first. Mm-hmm. And liaise with the families before making that announcement. You wouldn't make that announcement without advising the families.
And we heard the Coast Guard Rear Admiral Shannon Gilreath there talking about the conditions and the movement in the water and the risks posed to those working there. So can you explain that to us? What is happening there for those rescue crews?
Well, the first rule of rescue is that you come back yourself, that the rescuer doesn't become the rescuee. Given that it's probably they're searching the seabed around the bridge, they have a number of problems. The temperature they can handle because of their equipment, but it would be black water, and because it'd be full of sediment, even torches wouldn't break through that blackness. So it's all done by feel, and at the same time, there'd be strong currents in that area. With all the wreckage and tangled steelwork on the seabed, on the riverbed, it would be quite hazardous, and you'd do it very, very slowly.
Mm-hmm. And how long would a recovery operation like that normally continue for?
It depends on the national criteria. In Ireland, we carry on for 21 days, but I think we're probably the only country in the world that does it for that length of time, because a body can come back after 21 days. After that, it's not possible. But in like the UK, they would finish after 12 hours. And in the US will be something similar. So they will probably keep on going for today and may cut it off after that. They'd carry on doing after that would be keeping a surface presence downriver in case one of the victims came back up and they look to recover that way rather than putting divers in peril.
And then you have the job of clearing the area to allow that very important port to operate. That's a huge job of work, isn't it?
It's massive and it's going to take weeks and weeks. If the ship itself looks to be in reasonably good condition, that can be towed back to a pier quite quickly, I would think, for investigation and repairs. But the actual bridge itself, that will take some heavy lifting equipment that have to be brought in from wherever it is at the moment, and that will take weeks. But they have to clear the passageway, the the channel first, because the shipping that's stuck in the port has to get out, mm-hmm. because shipping is the lifeblood of any country.
All right, well, we're going to find out more about that just now. But for now, Chris, thank you very much. That's Chris Reynolds. Captain Nick Sloan is with us, salvage master and former president of the International Salvage Union. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning, Claire, and good morning to your listeners.
So let's talk about that salvage operation. There is some pressure on this because we heard yesterday on the programme just how important the port of Baltimore is. How long is it likely to take, and how does it all work?
Yeah, so the first attention will be to clear the wreckage off the bow of the actual dolly, the actual ship. And that itself has got quite a large structure of the bridge that's across the bow. So they're going to have to stabilize the vessel. There's a bit of bad weather covering them as well, so they'll mostly need some additional harbor tugs to hold her in place. As you're aware, there's about 30 ships that are trapped inside the port that are hoping to leave. But as Chris mentioned, this is not going to be hours. This is going to take days to clear that wreckage. So I'd imagine 48 to 72 hours as a minimum to clear the wreckage off the bow and then try and get the ship back out of the area and back alongside the port. Obviously, she had a mechanical failure before the incident, so they can't rely on her engine, so they'll tow her with as many tugs as they need to get her back to the port. Mm-hmm. And then the teams need to focus on cleaning the actual channel, focus on the channel debris. So there's a large part of that suspension bridge is collapsed inside the channel, and there you need heavy crane barge lifting equipment. And then the divers have to make sure that it's safe for them to actually go and do the rigging and bring out the pieces one by one. So that's also, I'd say, at least a week to 2 weeks' work. So the impact on the Port of Baltimore is huge, and that's without looking at the long-term requirement to clear the rest of the bridge structure and replace the bridge, which would be years before it's back into operation.
Mm-hmm. And it needs to happen pretty quickly, because we did hear yesterday that port is extremely important in terms of international shipping, isn't it?
Yeah, correct. So it's the largest car export port in the US. And at the moment, there's multiple responders from all over the East Coast of America that have mobilized to try and assist in this regards. It most really will be federalized. That means that they'll declare it a federal emergency, and then the FEMA Act takes over. And that means that additional resources can be mobilized to speed up the operation. But certainly, yeah, it's a massive crisis and something that you hope never happens.
Were you very surprised to see it, as surprised as the rest of us were when we watched that shocking footage yesterday?
You know, these ships are getting bigger and bigger. So this one isn't the biggest in the world, but she's still well over 100,000 tons. And she was doing about 8.5 knots when she had the first blackout or mechanical failure. And she was still doing 7.5 knots. Yeah, they tried to slow her down by dropping the port anchor, and then they got the engines going full astern. But she only reduced that speed from 8.5 to 7.5 knots. And you think of that sort of 12, 14 kilometers an hour, and you think of three football fields, 100,000 tons hitting a bridge. Unfortunately, the bridges are not designed for this. So the ships are getting bigger and bigger. And when something goes wrong, then the accidents are getting bigger and bigger as well.
So will questions be asked about the underwater buffers on those supporting pillars at all bridges where these large ships are expected to pass under?
Yes, there was an incident in Argentina about 2 years ago. And after that incident, they actually went and put large concrete caissons around the footprint of the baseline of the supports. And that operation took 18 months, but with very large bespoke concrete buffers to try and deflect ships and protect that. And I think you're going to see that this is going to become a requirement wherever these large ships are. You're going to have to put this, because you can't allow this to take place again.
Mm-hmm. There'll be repercussions for the insurance industry as a result of this too.
Oh, yeah. No, so the liability claims on this one, not only you got the ship's damage, which is one thing, then you've got the cargo delays that are going to come into place, because obviously the ship's not going anywhere quickly and they're going to try and ship the cargo. And then, of course, you've got all the third-party claims, so the massive loss of the bridge structure, and then the liability claims. And I think it's going to take years and years for the lawyers to actually come to an agreement. but it's going to be a large impact on the industry for this year, for sure.
Captain Nick Sloan, good to talk to you again, and thank you for joining us. Marco Forgione is Director General at the Institute of Export and International Trade in the UK. Good morning, Marco.
Good morning.
Now, officials have said that the traffic through the port, the maritime traffic, last year it amounted to 47 million tonnes of foreign cargo. It's going to be suspended now until further notice. And we've heard all of those reasons outlined this morning. But what's going to be the impact on global supply chains of that?
Well, it's another significant disruption to global supply chains. You know, on top of what's happening with the Panama Canal being constrained and what's happening in the Red Sea, this is just a further disruption, as was highlighted. This is the ninth busiest port in the US. It's number one for the import and export of vehicles. It's also a key exporter for liquefied natural gas, LNG. 500,000 tons that are exported each month. And that has relevance for the UK and the EU particularly, because the US is the number one exporter of LNG. So, you know, our energy is going to be potentially affected by what's happened here. Then we have to assess the impact of the over 40 ships that were due to be berthing in Baltimore over the next couple of weeks that now need to be redirected probably to New York, New Jersey, or Norfolk on the east coast of the US. And you then need to adjust the on-land supply chain and logistics sector to deal with that. So you've got the road and rail congestion on top of the port congestion that can be caused by this disruption. And all of that is going to take many weeks to resolve and for those new supply routes to be implemented.
But can those contingency plans work for a relatively short period of time? Can it be done?
Yes, it can be done, but it's not without challenge, and we run the risk of there being slight pressure on prices, that there could be a result in shrinkflation or indeed in availability in the short term. Certainly in the medium term, the supply chains will adjust to this disruption. And then it's a case of how quickly we can get Baltimore Port back up and operational. As your previous speaker was saying, you've got about 10 ships that are stuck in port now. And how does their cargo get moved, particularly since one of the key routes into the port for freight was through the over the bridge that's now not there. So the congestion and impact of this is going to ripple out for many weeks now.
Mm-hmm. And we have problems in international shipping, as we know, and we've spoken a lot on this programme about what's happening in the Red Sea. We also have delays in the Panama Canal. So all of these factors are going to combine and cause these problems that you've outlined, ultimately more costs for consumers.
Yes, and what we're seeing is that the global supply chains, the global integrated supply chains, are incredibly fragile. And whether that's due to direct action, what we're seeing with the conflict in the Red Sea, by environmental forces such as the drought that's impacting the Panama Canal, or by accidents, you know, unexpected accidents, as we've seen with Baltimore. And we have to look at how we can shift from the just-in-time, highly efficient but incredibly fragile supply chains to a more resilient, anti-fragile supply chain of the future.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you say that the images of that bridge collapsing have sent shockwaves around the world. Anyone who saw it was very shocked. But the impact on the business of the people who you represent and who you work with is going to be immense over the next number of months.
Yeah, as the supply chain seeks to adjust to this event, this human tragedy is going to take a few weeks. But they will adjust. We will deal with that. And a new system of supply chain in the short term will be established. And the priority today, having just heard that this is now a recovery rather than a search and rescue situation. Our hearts obviously go with the individuals, families and the communities that have been impacted. But the effects on trade aren't insignificant. You know, Home Depot and Amazon have huge distribution warehouses in the Baltimore port area. So they themselves now are going to be looking at how they adjust and amend their supply chains.
Marco, thank you very much for joining us. Marco Forgione, who's Director General at the Institute of Export and International Trade in the UK.